Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a CD of an Easter and Ascension sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Ascension Day, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Easter and Ascension sermons.
If the leadership is unable to speak truth and to deal with the fallout, then they should have enough integrity to step aside and elect a pope and start appointing bishops who will deal with this truthfully.
That's Father James Scahill, a priest in Massachusetts, who, among others, is calling for the resignation of Pope Benedict over priestly abuse scandals that has now come home to the Vatican, so to speak. This is not a new call. Those outside the pale of Roman Catholicism will often talk about these kinds of things. The outrage is understandable, but the prospect, how plausible? Dr. James Hitchcock joins us for the next few minutes of Issues Etc. this Monday afternoon, April the 19th, to talk about the Pope and the prospect of resignation. He's professor of history at St. Louis University and a regular guest. Dr. Hitchcock, welcome back.
Thank you.
First of all, is it going to happen?
No, it isn't going to happen. I'm virtually certain. I think the criticisms of Pope Benedict are, for the most part, quite unfair, because there's quite a bit of evidence, I think, that he is the one person of the Vatican who some years back began to realize how serious the problem was and has gone to greater lengths to address the problem than John Paul II did, and that, in fact, most bishops did. So I think it's a question here partly of his being scapegoated. I think it's totally unrealistic, however, to think that under any circumstances almost that a pope would resign, although it has rarely happened in the distant past.
The if you would, review for us the connection that is apparently, or in the minds of some, new between Pope Benedict and the scandal of priestly abuse.
Well, I'm not familiar with anything that may have broken very recently. You may be referring to when he was in head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, that he delayed the request for removing a priest from the priesthood in Milwaukee. Is that the incident you're referring to?
There are several. Also in Munich, he was archbishop there, I believe.
Oh, in Munich, yes. Well, there was an incident in Munich in which a priest from another diocese came into Munich for therapy. He had been accused of pedophilia, and he was then subsequently assigned to another parish, although there's no evidence, I think, that he carried on his activity. In the case of Munich, people who are familiar with the situation there have said that it was a huge diocese. Benedict came into that office primarily as a theologian. He didn't function all that much as an administrator. His vicar general, which would be his administrative second in command, says that he himself was responsible for the reassignment of the priest, and that Benedict didn't know about it. That's all I know on the subject at this point. In the case of the incident in Milwaukee, the Archdiocese of Milwaukee was petitioning for the priest to be laicized, and that process was delayed by Cardinal Ratzinger. But he had already been removed from the active ministry, and the laicization made no difference in terms of how he would actually be functioning in his ministry. That was under the control of the archdiocese.
There seems to be two aspects to the hesitancy to laicize the offending priests here. One seems to be, until lately, a heavy reliance on psychotherapy and psychological a remedy for those with these inclinations. And the other one seems to be kind of a more intra-diocese and intra-church hesitancy to remove priests. Talk about both of those briefly, if you would.
Yes, I think there's no question that there's a certain amount of clericalism here. The tendency of a profession, in this case the clergy, to kind of close ranks around their own. The usual claim is, well, we police our own ranks. We don't have the outside, outsiders don't have to get involved. and then very often there are cover-ups, if you want to call them that. And I think that's been a pretty consistent pattern, at least with the cases that I'm aware of in the United States. There's also, I think, in Rome's case, some concern with the idea of due process, that a priest, a bishop writes to Rome and say, I want to remove this man from the priesthood, and then Rome says, well, anyway, what procedures have you followed? Has he been given a fair hearing? Have you really proven the case against him, and so forth, which is what leads sometimes to great delays. The therapy part of it is really ironic because it represents what I would say was a 180-degree turn that the Church took after the Second Vatican Council of the 1960s. Prior to that time, the Catholic Church had tended to hold psychotherapy at arm's length, very suspicious, thinking that it had perhaps anti-Christian roots with Sigmund Freud, thinking that it was, in fact, a denial of moral responsibility by turning everything into a psychological problem. Then suddenly they wake up at around 1965 and they say, wait a minute, we've been missing out on something here. There are times when psychotherapy really is called for. Perhaps some people have psychological problems, not so much moral problems. And then they sort of went to the other extreme, which is what often does happen. And I think that's a good example of what's happened here. I think back in the 50s, cases like this we usually dealt with when some priest was caught in a sex scandal, for example. He was often sent off to a monastery to do penance. And then somebody says, oh, wait a minute, that's not a very enlightened way of dealing with the problem.
Two final questions. Why don't the media appear to care much for Pope Benedict?
Well, I think he's a lightning rod. He was a great defender of doctrinal orthodoxy. That was his position. And in fact, got a lot of enemies within the Catholic Church, who for that reason, are critics, let's say, who will often cooperate with the media. And I think he's viewed as the man, you know, who's standing in the way and saying no to all the developments of the modern world that secular humanists would like to promote. So therefore, seemingly catching him in a position where he's tolerant of blatant immorality is a very, very tempting target. And I don't think the media has been very careful to distinguish or to understand all the ramifications of these cases. I don't say that the Pope acted absolutely correctly in all situations. I think there are obviously situations where he did make a mistake, but I think the media has approached this by painting with a very, very broad brush. And I think the recent question, you know, that was raised apparently today, whether Pope should or would resign, is sort of just headline hunting. I think anybody who looks into it a little bit would see how improbable, maybe even impossible, that is.
What are the lessons to be learned from the sexual abuse crisis in the Roman Catholic Church?
Well, the lessons, it seems to me, are very simple, and that is act swiftly and act thoroughly. We now know, apparently, that we've heard now that people with that propensity may be almost irreformable. So you can't just say, "Oh, they've been treated, they've been cured, they can go back again." I think resort to police if necessary. A Vatican policy on that was released a few days ago, apparently the policy that's been in effect for a while, telling bishops that if report things like this to the police. I think that the a lot of failure on the part of most bishops, in fact, to deal forthrightly and swiftly with this problem, and that's the root of so many other things. For example, priests who say they were falsely accused, surely some must have been falsely accused. Everybody's skeptical. If a bishop were known to have investigated very thoroughly and distinguished between the innocent and the guilty, then if a particular priest were exonerated, people would accept that. But I think people are very, very suspicious because they see that bishops basically exonerated people who were obviously guilty. I think other institutions in our society are going to be faced with this same question. We know it exists within public school teaching, and it exists with the clergy of other denominations. It exists with Boy Scout leaders, you know, go on down the line. I guess the Catholic Church is kind of the bird in the canary in the coal mine who's letting other people know the poisonous gases that are coming.
Then, with only about 30 seconds, has there ever been a papal resignation?
There have been several. In the early church, a couple of popes resigned because they were being sent off to the mines by the Romans, or at least one did. They knew they weren't coming back. The most notorious case, really, was 1295, I think, where they elected an elderly hermit to be pope because they were deadlocked, and he was a very holy man, but apparently the burdens of the office were just completely too much for him, and he resigned after a year or two, and that created a sort of a chaotic situation. Then at the time of this so-called Great Western Schism in the late 14th, early 15th century, when there were rival claimants for the papal office, that was finally settled in 1415 by two of the three claimants resigning, and the third one then being declared to be deposed. Since that time, it's not been a... It's not ever, not even been an issue. There have been cases. I believe Leo the 13th died in 1903, may have been somewhat senile towards the end of his life. That would be the kind of issue, of course, that would be a real troublesome one, because who determines whether the Pope is still competent to carry on or not? That's canon law is not at all very clear about that.
Dr. James Hitchcock is professor of history at St. Louis University. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Hey, thank you.
A little bit later, we'll be talking with Deaconess Pam Nielsen on this Monday afternoon about Jesus, our Good Shepherd, right after this break. Mary Spaulding Balsh will join us from National Right to Life to talk about two new abortion laws in Nebraska. And Dr. John Warwick Montgomery will join us to talk about a Supreme Court decision on subsidies for student groups and a Wall Street Journal column titled, "Is the Supernatural Only Natural?"
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House. Listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House. cph.org.
Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a CD of an Easter and Ascension sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Ascension Day, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Easter and Ascension sermons.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
The pro-abortion health care bill passed, and lawsuits are already being filed to stop it. Dr. Jane Orient, Executive Director of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, says the bill spells the end of freedom in medicine as we know it. The group says it wants to preserve individual liberty and prevent the bankruptcy of the U.S. generally and Medicare and Social Security specifically. In addition, the attorneys general of 19 states have filed suits to prevent the bill from being enacted. They say it's unconstitutional because it infringes on the rights of states and individuals to manage their own affairs. Pro-lifers oppose the new law because it poses an enormous threat to innocent human life and medical professionals who want to protect them.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.